Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Cara, acne can be tough. Whether your kid is just starting to get breakouts or has been struggling with them for years, there's a great product that can help.
Phyla is the ultimate game changer. It tackles acne right at its root cause, rebalancing the skin's bacteria and packing it with probiotic phages.
Phyla harnesses the superpowers of probiotics, tiny warriors targeting and wiping out the acne-causing bacteria. In studies, Phyla slashed acne-causing bacteria by a whopping 90%.
Phyla doesn't just fix acne you can see. It stops new breakouts in their tracks. It has no harsh chemicals and won't irritate or dry most skin. Phyla's three-step system is like a dermatologist-approved magic potion. Cleanse, apply serum, and moisturize twice a day.
As a special treat for our listeners, you can grab 25% off your first order of Phyla. Head over to phylabiotics.com, enter code PUBERTY at checkout, and kickstart your family's journey to acne-free skin. Check out the link in our show notes for quick access.
Hi, I'm Cara Natterson.
And I'm Vanessa Kroll Bennett.
And we are obsessed with flipping puberty positive.
Puberty is a stage of life best described as a roller coaster of physical and emotional shifts. It happens to literally every human being on earth. And it shouldn't be cringy. It should feel, you know, pretty comfortable.
Which is why we started this podcast and a newsletter, and why we film slightly ridiculous but informative social media videos.
It's why we have a brand that makes clothes that literally feel so comfortable, and why we write books too. Our latest is This Is So Awkward, Modern Puberty Explained.
We have built a universe of puberty positivity, and it all started with this podcast.
We are so happy that you're here.
This episode was a long time coming, Vanessa. I mean, first of all, because we have a guest, Jess Leahy, who we've admired forever, and we're so excited to have her. But second of all, because we have been remiss in not starting to get episodes up about substance use disorder and addiction. And I think this is our first episode dedicated to a topic that is so important and needs so many episodes. With Jess, we cover everything from the definition of terms, like when can you say addiction and when should you be using substance use disorder. We cover tween and teen substance issues. We cover adult substance issues and look at the difference between the two. We talk about different substances and what happens in the brain. We talk about why people become addicted and the difference between use and addiction. I mean, it's an incredible survey course in this topic.
And it's a great companion to an episode we did with Dolly Clock in the past about teen party culture. And we will also have Dolly back on to update information about what terminology kids are using and cover ground with the most addictive substance out there, which is nicotine in its various forms. So this is a great companion. Jess, many of you have read her books already. She's a teacher, a writer, a mom. She writes about education, parenting, and children for The Atlantic and Vermont Public Radio and The New York Times. And her two books, and she's working on a third, her New York Times bestselling book, The Gift of Failure, is one of my own parenting touchstones about how important it is to let kids fail. And her second book is called The Addiction Inoculation, and it is all about the science of substance use disorder and the prevention and how we talk to kids about addiction and substances. And we got a bunch of questions from folks that we wove into this conversation about how do we educate our kids and ourselves on this really important topic? And how do we have these conversations, which are not easy? So we know you will enjoy and learn so much from this episode.
Hi, Jess. We're so happy to have you here.
I am so excited to be here.
You've been in my ear for a very long time because I actually listened to your books, which was an amazing experience. And then, of course, your Instagram series. So you're very much, you're not an earworm because it's a good thing the way you're in my ear, but you're very much in my ear. And it's very, what you talk about is so resonant. And so we're going to jump in and we're going to jump in on the topic of addiction. We're just going straight there.
Perfect.
And I think everyone listening is touched in some way by this topic, some more directly than others. Can you start us off with sort of helping us set the stage? How is your own story a piece of your writing? Tell us how it's informed your work, all that.
So first, I'm going to start with terminology, because while addiction is the word that everyone uses, it's on the cover of my book, substance use disorder. For the writers in the audience, if you look in the style guides, it's been switched over now. So I am a woman with substance use disorder, which problematic for us writers who like to be concise and use terminology that people are used to, but technically that's the right way to go about it. I happen to call myself an alcoholic. So I was born to an alcoholic. One of my parents was raised by an alcoholic. One of my grandparents was raised, and so on and so on and so on. My husband comes from a family with a long line of substance use disorder in it. So I came to my alcoholism later in life. And, you know, that isn't as abnormal of a situation as I thought. I thought I was like some oddball going into recovery meetings. I'm not. But I got sober in 2013 when I was 43 years old. And so it's been, you know, over 10 years. However, when I first got sober, my first thought was, well, crap, like, how do I make this stop here? You know, we talk all the time about like stopping the cycle of violence, of poverty, or whatever it is. And I didn't know how, like, the fact that my kids have genetics for substance use disorder, like, is that a thing? What does that mean? What percentage of whatever? I needed all these answers. And my job is pretty cool, which is to get curious about something and then just go into my hermit hidey hole in Vermont and read everything. Like, you should see the piles. I'm working on my next book, and the piles of books in here is insane, and paper and studies. So essentially, I just wanted to figure out, what does this mean for my children, and what would be best practices for arresting this intergenerational thing, if I can, if that's even a thing, and sort of, you know, knowing I can't ever, there's no guarantees ever. But what does the evidence say? What does the good, solid research say is the best path forward to prevent it in my kids, but also in my students? Because students feature prominently in my book, and I've had many students with substance use disorder, and one has died of it, and a couple others, one other that's featured in the book had her life permanently altered by it. So, yeah.
And I want to dive deep into substance use disorder, but can we start actually at that 30,000 foot view of addiction in general? Because I agree with you both on the conciseness scale, and also there are lots of different kinds of addiction, and the what happens inside the brain, whether it's substance use or something else, is actually a fairly similar sort of lowest common denominator path. And so maybe we can just start there a little bit about what's happening inside the brain of someone who, and we can use substances as the example, because we're going to go really deep into substances, but what happens when someone, do you want to just sort of walk us through what happens when someone uses a substance? And then,
Jess, can you just define for people what a substance use disorder is?
Yeah, that's a really good, so this sort of gets at this very complicated picture of, you mentioned that people can be addicted to things other than a chemical that you actually put into your body that attaches to receptors in your brain and alters the way your brain works. Some people are like, well, isn't screen addiction a thing? Well, like any field of study, there are all these like very entrenched encampments that are like, no, this is a brain disease, or this is a developmental disease, or this is a, you know, this is a trauma response. And all of that is true. And the nice thing is I don't have, I'm mixing metaphors here, but I don't have a horse in any one of these races. So I get to sort of say, yes, it is a brain disease. Yes, it is a developmental disorder. And the reason we can call it a developmental disorder is that the majority of people, if they're going to start using substances, are going to use them during their adolescence, right? So the number of people who start using substances and end up with this thing, substance use disorder, really drops off after your brain finishes developing in the, you know, mid-20s. So there's that. So I just wanted to sort of, you know, so if we want to talk about addiction to porn, gambling, you know, all those things, what we're talking about is, and the best book to read for this, by the way, is Anna Lemke's Dopamine Nation. It's an incredible book. She talks about the dopamine cycle. Dopamine is a big part of this picture. But it's not like with those screen and porn and gambling, it's not like you are introducing a chemical into the brain that actually attaches to your receptors. So it's sort of important to draw that line. Some people say that you can't be addicted to sex, to gambling, to porn, whatever, because it's not a chemical, whatever. I don't care. There are these neurotransmitters in the brain that need to attach to receptors in your brain. And when they do attach to those receptors in your brain, you can feel pleasure. You can feel it can take your pain away. You know, we're talking about things like opiates. And then there are endogenous or chemicals that come from inside of our own bodies that can also attach to those receptors. Like we happen to have the receptors for the main chemicals in cannabis. We have those endogenous receptors for that in our brain, which implies obviously that we have the chemical endogenous in our bodies as well. And we don't fully understand what that chemical does in our bodies. There's a really great episode actually of the Huberman Lab podcast where he talks about cannabis and the brain and the body, alcohol and the brain and the body, and nicotine and the brain and the body, three separate episodes. And those are a really great starting point to understand exactly how those chemicals work in the brain and body. So the problem is that, for example, something like an opiate, let's say you take, you know, you take heroin, you take any kind of pain pill that has opiates in it, it will attach to those receptors in huge amounts, way more than we could ever, you know, muster in our little bodies. So you go, oh, you know, that experience is so much bigger and more than any sort of response that we can generate inside of our own body using those same endogenous chemicals. And so it's sort of like this overwhelming, in the book, I talk about the fact that one of my students referred to it as taking an opiate is like getting a hug from God. You feel loved, you feel secure, there are no problems. We can't muster that in our own bodies with our own chemicals. So of course it's real, it's something, and I've told my kid this, I'm like, with something like opiates, you're going to like them. It's not, you know, yes, they make me throw up and stuff like that. Some people like them less than others, but generally speaking, it's warm, it's fuzzy, it's loving, it's all those things. And so knowing that is a really important part of talking about what's happening in the body and talking about why it's really important to be careful with those kinds of chemicals.
And just a side note about opiates in particular, I obviously come at this from the medical perspective. I also come at this from the perspective of having worked in teen residential drug rehabs. So I wear like all these different hats around this issue. And one of the things that I've watched over the years and that people describe so acutely to me and to every writer and podcaster out there is this sort of, with opiates in particular, the first high is the highest high. And that is because, you know, just to go with what you were describing in terms of how neurotransmitters work on receptors, it's that pairing of an oversaturation of neurotransmitters and their receptors when you take an opiate for the first time, and every one of those receptors is occupied, every single one. And the feeling, I mean, I've never heard, maybe you have, of anyone saying that feeling is anything less than unbelievably amazing. And it is the chasing feeling. Have you heard?
That's what's so interesting. I was given morphine. I was given morphine by IV after I had my first child. And it was one of the worst experiences of my entire life. I just, for whatever reason, like I just don't get it, except then I was given opiates again after my second C-section and in pill form. And then I got it. And I'm like, oh, this is dangerous. Yeah. But that first time, in fact, I lay there. In fact, someone else had, my husband had to take the baby away because I felt murderous. It was awful. And so I don't know what the difference is. I don't know if it was whatever, but you're so right about that first experience because people talk over and over and over again about every single use after that is an attempt to get as high as that first high. And it's just not going to happen. One of the things we know about when we take a substance is that, and this is discussed really, really well again in Anna Lemke's book, Dopamine Nation, also in Judith Grisel's Never Enough. She does an incredible job with this because she talks about the fact that there's an A cycle of the drug, which is where you go up. But the problem is the B cycle, when you come down, will take you lower than where you were in the first place. So, you know, the problem with this is every single time, for example, I drank to manage my anxiety, I had an up cycle that was great. And then it would take me lower and push me further into sort of a depressive state after the fact or into a more anxiety induced state. And it messed with my sleep, which messed with my anxiety, blah, 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 blah. So anyone who's taking substances can tell you that there's this constant struggle to get back to the high. And then after a while, as we often hear, you know, after a while, it's not even about the high, it's an attempt to get back to baseline. So when you watch people who are sort of in later stage substance use disorder, you know, people who are, for example, having to score heroin every day in order to take heroin every single day. And it's this whole chase to just get to a place where you're operational, where you can even begin to feel normal. So it's, you know, it's unfortunately, it's a vicious cycle of sending yourself lower and lower and lower over time. And that's because, you know, the receptors, you know, we're either killing them off in some circumstances or just not able to access them in the same way that we were in that first time. The problem is, this is such a technical discussion. And this is what's fun for me is taking this discussion that most people aren't interested in. In fact, my editor has gotten so used to just writing either jargon or nope, nobody cares or reel it back or whatever. So my chapters are usually about twice as long when I start. And then my editor helps me see, no, that's too far. Take it back.
Well, Jess, this is an audience that loves the science and they love understanding the science behind behaviors and parenting choices. And in particular, this is a group that is really fascinated by how teens' brains work.
Oh my gosh.
Because it drives so many decisions, both from a parenting perspective and obviously from a kid's own perspective. A really important part of your work is understanding how teens' brains work so that we can
Love teens' brains so much. They're so endlessly fascinating.
Come sit by us. Come sit by us.
So oh my gosh.
I mean, we could do a whole episode just on teen brains, but for this particular episode, help us understand what the landscape of the teen brain is, why it's seeking risk and pleasure anyways, and then why it's more susceptible to addiction and setting people on a lifelong path of substance use disorder. But ground us first in the baseline landscape of the teen brain.
So since your audience likes this stuff, I'm going to recommend three books. Lauren Steinberg's Age of Opportunity, Dan Siegel's book about the teenage brain, and Frances Jensen's book about the teenage brain. And I always switch those two titles. So anyway, those three books I just adore. It depends on, you know, what angle you want to go with. You know, when kids are little, you know, the brain develops from the basement up, the basement being our limbic system, our like breathing and our respiration and our reacting brain, our recoiling from pain, are striking out in fear. So little kids, so good at the reacting, right? And this is one reason that it's so great to start teaching kids about how their brains work from a very, very young age, because you can help them understand that when they're little and they really get mad at another kid and they just want to reach out and just whack another kid, that's their lower brain. And that's the part of the brain that we're trying to balance with the upper brain. And that's called integration. And that's, you know, fully integrated people don't really happen until their brains are done developing, because the upper part of the brain, while it's present, it's there physically, it's just not wired up yet. Because it's there. The matter is there. Not to get into too much detail, the matter itself changes over. There's this gray matter versus white matter stuff that's in all the books that I just recommended. That's fascinating, that stuff right there. That has to do with myelination.
We love myelination.
Well, and I often describe it to people as when you talk about someone. So what's happening is myelination is happening, which is like, if you're an electrician, if you have electrical wires that don't have any insulation on the outside, they're just the bare wires. They're incredibly inefficient because you're losing signal out all over the place. But when you put that insulation on the outside of the wires, it keeps the signal all going in the same direction and makes things much more efficient and much more all that sort of stuff. So that's happening in the brain. We start out, you know, that top part of the brain in particular is not really myelinated. So it's turning white from gray to white. So that's happening. Synapses are starting to talk to each other. And what we know about synapses and the cells that they're attached to is that they only continue to talk to each other as long as they're talking to each other. So when communication is sort of shut down in the brain, the synapses are like, oh, there's no one to talk to. And they, you know, die off. So many synapses are being created in every second. And I don't have the numbers at my fingertips in the adolescent brain. So all that is happening, which is making, if you imagine like a tree that's making more and more and more and more and more branches so that there's just so many different pathways. And we love pathways because later on in adolescence, this process called pruning, and I happen to love the gardening analogies, pruning is going to happen later where the brain is like, oh my gosh, we have so many connections. Let's get rid of some of them so we can have like a more efficient way to make this brain work. But in the meantime, you want as many connections happening as possible, which is why it's so great for kids to try things that are outside their comfort zone. Or if you have a very clumsy kid and that kid takes gymnastics or dancing or some movement-oriented thing, you're making new connections. If you are the kind of kid who doesn't love to paint or touch squishy things, the more you do those things, you know, the more pathways you're making. So understanding that adult substance use is different from adolescent substance use is incredibly important because this period from puberty until early to mid 20s, this period of immense, incredible cognitive restructuring and development and plasticity, which just means that our brain is acutely sensitive to external forces, to the environment. And that can be chemicals, that can be trauma, that can be it can be positive influences too. If you feel loved and safe and supported, then, you know, that's great for your brain. Whereas if you are feeling like your life is uncertain and you could get hit at any moment, that can also do things to your brain. But essentially we have genetics, we have epigenetics, and we have environment and as risk factors for substance use disorder.
Vanessa, we literally have 3 minutes to eat lunch every day. I am not joking. And the challenge is how to make it delicious and healthy and still fit into that tiny window. Our answer is Factor's ready-to-eat meals. They have been a godsend.
We throw our Factor meals in the microwave. It takes 2 minutes and out comes a gorgeous, fresh, never frozen meal. We both love the tamale vegetarian one. It's delish. There's a ton of options every week. There's 60 add-ons, breakfast, snacks, beverages. I love doing the wellness shots with my kids. They think it's hilarious. And I know they're getting vitamins and minerals in their bodies.
So get meals on your table or at your desk in 2 minutes or less. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, and cleaning. You can customize with flexibility to get as much or as little as you need, and you can press pause or reschedule depending upon your lifestyle.
So to order, go to factormeals.com/puberty50 and use the code puberty50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That code is puberty50 at factormeals.com/puberty50 to get 50% off your first box, 20% off your next box. And I am going to go do that right now because I need more Factor meals in my refrigerator. Cara, lately I have been lying awake at night. I'm physically exhausted, but I can't sleep because my mind is so wired with everything going on between work and my family. So I've added Magnesium Breakthrough to my nightly routine, and it actually helps calm my mind. It helps me get better sleep, and I wake up feeling better rested. I'm less cranky. And I'm more patient with my family and with you.
Oh, I've noticed. And it's because, unlike other magnesium supplements that might give one or two formulations of magnesium, Magnesium Breakthrough has seven. That's why you're sleeping so well and waking up refreshed. Now, dietary supplementation is always best, Vanessa. So that means eating your minerals and vitamins is the best way to get them in. But if you can't or you don't get enough, Magnesium Breakthrough is the way to go. It can also help digestion, though too much helps your digestion too much, which is not a good thing. It can support muscle recovery. So bye-bye, Charlie horses. And it helps build dense bones, which is especially important for women approaching and in menopause.
We have an exclusive offer for our listeners. You can go to buyoptimizers.com/puberty, buyoptimizers.com/puberty. And you can use the code PUBERTY10 during checkout to save 10%. That promo code is PUBERTY10 at buyoptimizers.com/puberty. Your body and brain and family and business partner will thank you.
Cara, my kids love Magic Spoon cereal, and even though it's cereal, they actually love it as a homework snack. The variety pack has four flavors, cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter, and fruity is the favorite flavor in my house.
Now, this pack has 0 grams of sugar, between 13 and 14 grams of protein, and between 4 and 5 grams of net carbs per serving. It's made with wholesome ingredients, no artificial flavors or dyes, and it's high in protein, gluten-free, grain-free, and soy-free. So a great choice, Vanessa.
You can go to magicspoon.com/puberty to grab a variety pack and try it today. And be sure to use our, you guessed it, promo code PUBERTY at checkout to save $5 off your order. And Magic Spoon is so confident you're going to love their product. It's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they will refund your money. No questions asked. They do not want you to send their cereal back to them.
Try a bowl of Magic Spoon cereal today at magicspoon.com/puberty and use the code PUBERTY to save $5. Can you connect some dots for us here about substance use, experimentation and substance use disorder in tweens, teens, and young 20-somethings who have these myelinating and pruning brains, as opposed to your own path, which was coming at this with a fully myelinated, although we are all pruning the rest of our life. So pruning goes on forever and ever and ever, but you had a fully myelinated brain. So walk us through kind of how those two paths differ and what's common between them and how should we sort of compartmentalize them? Because then we're going to get deep into how we talk to kids about substances.
I never get to go this deep. Let me just say, this is so much fun. I never get to geek out like this. So this is a really complicated picture, mainly because in order to talk about me and compare me to someone else, we have to talk about, okay, well, what are genetics? Like, okay, so the genetics for substance use disorder, it looks like genetics are about 50 to 60% of the risk picture. That comes from Dr. Mark Schuchat out of University of California, San Diego. And that's sort of the best estimate we have right now. So I have, my children have this sort of elevated genetic risk within us. There's a horrible analogy, which is unfortunately really apt, which is that genetics are the bullet that's in the gun, and that bullet can sit there in that gun forever and never hurt anybody, but trauma is the trigger that releases the... And if you go look at the work of someone like Gabor Maté, you know, his work is that essentially he believes that substance use disorder is a response to trauma, full stop. That's what addiction is, substance use disorder is. You have to be comfortable with some gray area when you talk about this stuff, because even in the statistics, there are a lot of confounders in there that I do my best when I'm, for example, if I'm in an audience where I think there might be statisticians or someone who really understands statistics well, I have to acknowledge there are a lot of confounders here. So, okay, let's talk about adolescence. And a couple of things are happening just from a physical perspective. When the drugs enter the brain and they cross the blood-brain barrier and they get into the brain, they glom up receptors. And those receptors need to be available to other chemicals in our brain. For example, I talked before about the fact that we have endogenous cannabinoids in our body, and cannabis gloms those receptors up, right? in that Huberman Lab podcast that I was talking about, he makes the point, a really fascinating point, which is that we don't know what endogenous cannabinoids do in our body fully, but it would imply the more receptors we have for these endogenous cannabinoids, probably the more important it is, right? Well, we have the highest number of these receptors for endogenous cannabinoids during pregnancy and in the fetus during gestation. So why? We don't really know. But if we're glomming them up with the ones that we're introducing to our body through vaping or edibles or whatever, one might question, are we making it so that something else can't happen, right? So there's, like I said, a lot of gray area because this, we've only been able to look at inside the human brain and look at it while it's operating for the past generations. So a lot of this is really emerging stuff. We do know, for example, that in the brains of adolescents who use cannabis more than two times a week, which is what's known as chronic, which freaks some people out, like twice a week, that hippocampus can be smaller. And the hippocampus is, for example, the seat of memory formation, consolidation, all that kind of stuff. And we see some thinning in the parts of the brain that do the adulting part, the prefrontal cortex, the frontal lobe, that kind of stuff. So, and we don't tend to see that same change in adults when they use that drug. And there seems to be something about the adolescent brain and the fact that it's still developing, that it's still becoming, that it's not done yet, that's causing these changes.
Can I just interject one quick question? How old is that data? And do you anticipate that the data is going to look different as we have a generation of kids who are using higher and higher concentration cannabis? Because I know we'll get that question.
That is a fantastic question. And the answer is, I don't know. I would guess that because the technology wasn't there to look at, for example, my dad's brain when he was doing weed during the 70s. And now we can, and that's been since the advent of more potent strains of, and, you know, highly refined strains. So I don't know, but I think that's a fantastic question. And I would love to see that. And, you know, keeping in mind, there's so many cool angles to come at this because there are risk factors to substance use disorder. I would love full research to look at the brains of, you know, kids in foster care and group homes and what's happening in their brains, or kids who have been adopted and what's happening in their brains, and kids who go through their parents' separation and divorce and what happens in their brains. And there's, you know, all these categories of risk factors that I would love to see individual studies of, and they just don't really exist yet, which is unfortunate.
Jess, can you talk about what alcohol does to a teen brain? And one of the things you talk about is how they, like, the impact of alcohol is different. So, like, there's actually stuff that we as adults feel when drinking alcohol that kids don't have the same repercussions necessarily, like the visible repercussions. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. It's fascinating because it affects the way we talk to kids about substances. Like, if what we know is that, and we'll get to this in a minute, I guess, the, you know, the most effective substance use prevention that we know of starts super young, pre-K, kindergarten, involves good, solid evidence, the data we have on what's happening in the adolescent brain and what substances do to the adolescent brain. This is an important piece of it. And it also is an important safety issue. So I did not know this before I started doing all the research for this book. It's fascinating to me that, number one, the numbers we have for what constitutes, for example, binge drinking apply to adults, right? So adolescents, the American Academy of Pediatrics has been pushing for those numbers to be lower for adolescents than for adults because their bodies tend to be, yeah, sure, smaller, but also their brains are not done developing. And so the impact on the brain is different. But
and what you mean by that, just to be really clear, is the number of drinks consumed in a given amount
of
time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's defined by binge drinking. Okay. Great.
Yeah. So if it's 4 to 5 for boys as adults, for men, the AAP would love for it to be like 3 to 4 for boys during adolescence, and to be even lower for girls, because as it turns out, girls, it's not just about body composition. And, you know, we used to say, okay, well, boys have more muscle, which is more water, and girls have less muscle and more fat. So alcohol doesn't get broken down as quickly in the female body as it does in the male. But it turns out that it's not just about muscle and fat composition. It's actually about the things in our body that break down these chemicals that girls don't break down, especially adolescent girls don't break down alcohol as quickly as boys do. The other issue is that adolescents in general, when they are drinking, will not feel as drunk, as impaired as an adult with the exact same blood alcohol content or BAC, which is dangerous, right? You'd be more likely to drive. You'd be more likely to say, oh no, I'm good. I can totally handle this, right? And then to compound the situation, adolescents are going to be less likely to feel the negative impact the next day, the hangover stuff, right? You know, it's sort of the thing with adolescents. There's a great joke that was on the West Wing one time where this woman was like, yeah, teenagers, college students could eat Tupperware and be healthy. You know, it's that there's something the adolescent body and brain is just really forgiving in terms of like, you know, feeling the ramifications of their behaviors. So they're less likely to feel hungover, less likely to feel incapacitated by dehydration or whatever that thing is. So they're less likely to go, oh man, I overdid it last night and, you know, say, oh, I don't want to do that again. So there's this incredible, I mean, even if you're just telling your kids, look, teenagers do not feel the same impact, the same level of intoxication that an adult would with the same blood alcohol content. But if you get pulled over and the police breathalyze you, you're going to have the same level of intoxication. And just because you don't feel it as much, that makes it a lot more dangerous for you. You're more likely to do things that might not be safe because you feel like, oh no, I'm cool. I'm just buzzed. I'm not drunk, but that's just not true.
Can you get into some strategies of ways that both, let's start with parents and adult caregivers. How can they start preventing substance use or preventing the escalation to substance use disorder? Because mm-hmm. they're right, those are two different things.
Right.
What are some tips or do you have language that can help people?
Okay. So what you're talking about is the fact that, and we should reassure parents, the majority of kids are gonna be fine. Like they'll get past, you know, the heavy drinking in college and probably they'll be okay. Like their brains are still impacted by this thing, but most kids don't progress to substance use disorder, thankfully. However, as I said, I would like, especially as a teacher, their brains to be able to develop intact. And then there's this added level from a statistical standpoint. And again, yes, there are confounders in these statistics. It's a dweeby conversation, happy to have it. The younger a kid is when they first try drugs or alcohol, the more likely they are to develop substance use disorder over their entire lifetime. So if an eighth grader tries drugs or alcohol, you know, has a beer in eighth grade, more than a sip of beer in eighth grade, more than a sip is sort of the technical way that people measure substance use. It drives me crazy, but there we are. More than a sip of alcohol in eighth grade, their likelihood of developing substance use disorder over their lifetime is 47%. If they wait 2 years and get to 10th grade, that risk drops in half, like to 21 to 23%. Then if they wait another 2 years till they're in 12th grade, that can drop down to like 11%. Okay. And that
Jess,
has to
just,
do, yeah.
Can I just ask, do they see that as correlative or causal? Like,
yeah. So there's a correlation there. Coming up with causation in statistics, I'm married to a physician. I am the parent of someone, of an economist. We call each other on this all the time, right? Coming up with a causal relationship is so difficult to do unless you are controlling for everything right. else. So for example, the reason that there are confounders in these statistics is you can imagine that an eighth grader who tries alcohol might have more access. They probably have it laying around the house, maybe because their parents also have issues with alcohol use disorder. Maybe, you know, their peer group, you know, there's so many other factors that can affect that. And as much as we do try, researchers do try to strip away or control for all these other factors, it would be impossible to compare these kids without the, you know, since, for example, intergenerational trauma, since adverse childhood experiences or ACEs, these are all parts of it. And unfortunately, we're in a position where there are so many factors that we're trying to control for that it becomes almost impossible to put a causal relationship. You know, if you wanted a causal relationship between eating celery and cancer, you would need someone to eat essentially only celery. And it's very difficult.
I'm going to put in a plug for temperament and personality as well. Like,
yeah,
I used to watch babies when they were 6 months, 9 months, 12 mm-hmm. months old. And the ones who tried to take a flyer off the exam room table, those were the kids when they got older who loved risk seeking. They're just born to, And you never hear about temperament and studies. Right. So there are different variables. Well,
where you do actually, there's some really, really interesting study, really interesting work coming out now related to genetics and substance use disorder and personality and behavior. It's fascinating. I was really fortunate last year. I got to go to the Research Society on Alcoholism study because they gave me this wonderful award for my book in translating the research. But I got to go to all of these amazing sessions. And you know, the problem with the genetics piece, for example, is that there is no like one gene that we can pluck out with CRISPR technology and say, woohoo, we got the gene for addiction. It's not like that. It's tied into body and brain chemistry, and it's tied into temperament, personality, all these different things. And 100%, I look at certain kids. There was a kid that my oldest was friends with when he was little. And this kid scared me to death because he constantly had a cast on because he was constantly throwing himself off of roofs and falling into things, you know, and that kid just needed higher levels of stimulation in order to feel alive. We all know people like that, right? And those people, need higher levels of dopamine or adrenaline or whatever those neurotransmitters are that make us feel alive. So that's a part of it. And then on the other hand, although this is anecdotal, I could not find any research that anyone was willing to stick their name to on this, or any, even if I gathered a whole bunch of anecdotal evidence. I worked in a rehab for adolescents for 5 years, and I talked to a lot of people who work in rehabs for adolescents. And I often can guess what their drug of choice is before they tell me what it is, because there are just trends you see among kids who have undiagnosed learning issues, for example, ADHD, or kids who have been told, or kids who have had really high levels of adverse childhood experiences and just want to numb out. You know, those kids often, in my anecdotal experience, we'll go for the opiates, whereas the kids with ADHD are going to be more likely to go for the speed or the weed. Just the things that quiet the brain a little bit, right? Speed because of the paradoxical relationship in kids, not in adults.
Well, and because that's how you treat ADD with
exactly,
a
right.
And they are, I mean, this
right. They're
this
self-medicating.
Gets, right. Exactly. And they're,
and I hate that
question.
Term though. Like that term is so loaded, but
it makes
put
sense.
It, take it, right.
They're like,
take it to the extreme. And I wrote about someone I knew from the recovery community who had been addicted to everything. She refers to herself as a trash can, which is a horrible way to refer to yourself, but meaning she'll take anything that alters her brain chemistry. But this person specifically said, I took opiates because it allowed me to numb out for long enough that I didn't just kill myself. And she said, I hate to say this, but taking opiates until I was in a place where I could get help was the thing that saved my life. And I have a lot of sympathy for, you know, Georgia in the addiction inoculation. She was my student in high school, and she was a daily drinker by the time I met her in sophomore year of high school. That water bottle next to her desk didn't have water in it. Mm-hmm. And she started drinking in middle school because she heard someone in recovery that her well-meaning school brought in to explain to them about drug and alcohol use. And he said, when I drank, it allowed me to feel nothing. And she was like, ding, 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 ding. This is how I can not feel this crippling anxiety that is just devastating, because they were taking her, her parents were taking her to the doctor for her stomach aches, but no one was asking whether or not there was a brain connection to her stomach aches. And I can sympathize with her over that, because when I was in second grade, I begged to stay home every day with stomach aches because I had crippling anxiety, which is, as an adult, what led me to start drinking.
Mine was third grade. I didn't want to go to school all of third grade, and I had stomach aches. And luckily, I had a mom who was like, stomach aches seem like more than stomach aches. Let's talk a little bit about, like, let's pull all those threads together, right? So we're thinking about where kids are coming from. We're thinking about our own family histories. We're thinking about talking to kids about where they are in their development and their brain development and their socializing. And the temptation is, when we have these conversations, is either to go on full fear mode, right?
Scare tactics.
Scare tactics.
They don't work. Scare tactics don't work.
Full disclosure mode, like, right. oh, you should have seen me, you know, right. like we know we're not oversharing, and we know we're not just trying to scare the shit out of kids. Right.
Right.
We're trying to educate them, inform them without boring them to tears.
right.
And we're trying to meet them where they are. How do we walk this line? How do we mm-hmm. talk to them about this stuff that acknowledges this whole universe of reality and still give them good education about this stuff?
All right. So let me give you two versions. And knowing what I know about the research and knowing that I have I have read all of it, let's talk about what I do, because I'm trying to apply everything I can. Two versions. Starting from scratch, I get a do-over with my kids, right? So if I get a do-over, number one, I come into having kids knowing they're at higher risk. I come to terms with the fact that my parent isn't ready to get recovery yet, and I'm a lot more careful with leaving my kids with that parent. I talk to my kids about the reason that staying with grandma and grandpa isn't something that they can do all the time, because, and I don't, you know, you do this in a age appropriate kind of way, but as soon as they're old enough to understand why sometimes it's not okay for me to take them to grandma and grandpa's house, I start to say, because one of their grandparents has a disease that makes them want to drink more alcohol. And when they drink more alcohol, that it's not safe for me to leave them with them. And from a very early age, I'm doing things with my pre-K kindergartner, things like, why do you think that we don't swallow the toothpaste? Why do we just put the toothpaste on the outside mm-hmm. of our teeth and then spit it out? Well, because there's some things that we put inside of our body and ingest and get into our tummies. And there are some things that just go on the outside of our body, like face cream or shampoo. Oh, and you know how sometimes I were to drop this pill on the floor, look how much this pill looks like candy. That's why you need to come and talk to mommy or daddy or whomever before you put that in your mouth, because it's, look at these pills. These pills, sometimes they even have stuff on the outside side that tastes sweet. So it makes it even easier to take the pill, but these aren't candy and they can make you really, really sick when the kid gets older. You know, why do you think that there's my name on the outside of this pill bottle? Can you find the letters of mommy's name in this pill on the outside of this pill bottle? And why do you even think that name is there? Like, if you were sick and I was sick and we had the same thing, can you just take mommy's medicine? Well, of course not. We're different shapes. We're different sizes. We're different ages. We're just different people. And that's why you never take a prescription that doesn't have your name on the outside. And you plant the seeds for conversations that will happen later, like, sweetie, I just want to check in with you because taking prescription medications, for example, pain medications that belong to someone else, it's incredibly dangerous. 67% of parents know that their kids are probably, if they're going to misuse pain meds, are going to get them from your own medicine cabinet or from a friend's medicine cabinet. But only 10% of parents talk to their kids in this one survey about misusing prescription opiates. And then we need to get our brains around the fact that we need to get started, like I said, pre-K and K, and that it's not enough to wait until middle school, high school. I was in Tennessee a while ago. I always look up the usage for kids wherever I am, and most states have pretty good numbers. I was in Tennessee, and I noticed that the average age of initiation for drinking alcohol among kids in the state of Tennessee was 13.7 years old, which is sort of around the national average. But the average age of initiation for misusing prescription meds there is 13.5. So younger than the average age of initiation for misusing alcohol. So knowing this information is important for me because it can help me target my information better. But also talking to kids about the realities of the fact that the adolescent brain is not the adult brain. And here's what can happen in the adolescent brain. And here's what alcohol does to an adolescent that it doesn't do to an adult and why it needs to be different. So the best, most honest information we can give them. And here's the cool thing. There is a book for this. Like, if it makes you uncomfortable, there is a fantastic book that is a resource for adolescents on this topic and is appealing to adolescents. Even my highly credulous and highly just really suspicious teens in the adolescent rehab. And it's by David and Nick Sheff, and it's called Hi. David Sheff wrote the book Beautiful Boy and the book Clean. His son is Nick. Nick is the beautiful boy who is now in recovery. Adolescents just are drawn to this book. Please don't get your parents stink all over it by handing it to your adolescents and saying, oh, mommy wants you to read this book. Here, please read this. Just leave it around. They will pick it up. It's really brightly colored. It's really It does not talk down to adolescents. It doesn't do what my daughter refers to as talking like they think adolescents talk, but that's not really how it's just, it's really well done. Really, really well done. Leave things like that for them around. You know, increasingly high schools are figuring out the peer-to-peer sort of stuff really works well. And that's becoming a part of the education in schools. Find out what your school program is. Does your school have any kind of substance use prevention program at all? And how early does it start? Unfortunately, only 57% of high schools in this country have any substance use prevention program at all. And only 10% of that 57% are based on any evidence of efficacy. The one I went through as an adolescent actually raised my likelihood of using substances, not reduced them. That program has improved over time, but it's still not great. I list a bunch of them in the book. I give you the resource you can go look for that is constantly updating those efficacy results objectively from a third-party source. So just be aware of the programs that are out there, giving kids really good information about what drugs and alcohol do to their brains and bodies. The fact that as they get older, their chances of developing substance use disorder over their lifetime go down. And you don't have to say it that way. You can say, look, kids, mommy's an alcoholic. Daddy almost divorced mommy because mommy was an alcoholic. Mom could have lost her job because she was an alcoholic. I could have driven you when I was drunk when I was an alcoholic. I could have killed you when I was an alcoholic. I don't want you to have to go through that. I certainly don't want you to have to go through, you know, hitting what some people call a rock bottom before you get help. So all of this information that I'm giving you is so that you'll be less likely, because the longer you delay your first use, the less likely you will to experience that. And here's the good news. I think of getting to recovery as assembling a 100-piece puzzle. For me, my dad, the morning after I got blackout drunk at my mom's birthday party, was the 100th piece that slipped into place that made me say, yes, I need help, and I'm going today to a meeting. You hardly ever get to be piece 100. It's super rare. You can imagine. It's just, you know, but piece 2 and piece 37 and piece 72 and piece 98 had to be in place before piece 100 falls into place. So while I can never guarantee that my kids won't develop substance use disorder, in fact, there's a higher likelihood than I'm comfortable with that one of my kids will, or one of my sister's kids. But the more pieces of that puzzle are in place via prevention, the closer they'll be to that 100th piece if they do develop a problem with substances. So I can only hope that if they do, they're at piece 85 as opposed to piece 37. So they'll get close to rehab faster.
Can you say a word on how to talk about fentanyl poisoning? Because it's such a kind of unique and modern of the moment issue in these conversations. What's your guidance on that specific conversation?
Oh, I hate fear-mongering so much. Like, one of my jobs in journalism has been to dispel fear-mongering for parents. This is one area where I'm totally cool with being afraid of this, because what we know now about fentanyl is that fentanyl is a synthetic opioid. It's something that is being made in labs. It's not like heroin that comes from plants. It is being made in labs. It is an incredible gift to humanity in the sense that if you have end-stage bone cancer, for example, it is one of the only things that can help with pain management. So it is being used for totally legit purposes, and it is really helping people who need pain management. However, it's also making its way into a lot of drugs because it's really inexpensive, and a very, very small amount of it is way more potent than, you know, for example, a larger amount of morphine or whatever. So it's easier to hide and get into the country because you need so little of it to adulterate a large amount of, let's say, cocaine or Xanax. So what's increasingly happening is that a lot of these drugs, for example, counterfeit Xanax is a big place where we're seeing. So kids will go on Snapchat, purchase Xanax, think they're getting the real thing because they look almost identical. I mean, the DEA puts out lots of pictures of like real Xanax, prescription grade Xanax, and fake Xanax. You can't tell the difference. I mean, sometimes a little bit, but the problem is at this point, and I was at a conference recently where they said, look, if you've tried cocaine or speed or any of those sorts of or party drugs, then you have had fentanyl. You have probably had it. Like, luckily, if you're not dead, you didn't have enough to kill you, but a very, very, the amount that fits on the tip of a sharpened pencil lead can kill you. So I now know personally children who have ordered Xanax off the internet, took it as a way to celebrate, like, you know, yay, graduating. In fact, this is a real story. A classmate of my daughter ordered a bar of Xanax off of the internet, took it, dead next day. So, and my niece, girls that she wrestled with, my niece is a wrestler, cousins, ordered Xanax off the internet, or no, sorry, MDMA, what they thought was MDMA off the internet, took it, both of them dead. Fentanyl can kill you. So here's what we should be talking to kids about. We need to get over our fear that if we talk about it, they will want to do it. Because I just did a video on my Instagram Reels about kits that have fentanyl test strips, and it's called harm reduction. Sorry, that's the phrase I was going for and it disappeared. Harm reduction kits that have Narcan, which is something you can give to someone when they are overdosing on an opioid, like fentanyl or heroin or, you know, morphine or that kind of thing, OxyContin. You just stick it in your nose and you squirt it and it gloms up the transmitters and can bring them, literally can bring them back to life. And fentanyl test strips, which look like little pregnancy tests or COVID tests, and you can find out whether or not there's fentanyl in the drug that you are using. These are in my daughter's dorm first aid kits. I checked. These should be in every school's first aid kit. I live in Burlington and there is a fentanyl overdose problem here. I keep it in my glove compartment. You just never know. And you won't hurt someone, for example, if you give them Narcan. The other thing about fentanyl that I'd like just put out there is that fentanyl and another drug called xylazine or tranq, they're being mixed together a lot now. It is a not approved for humans horse tranquilizer sedative. The other problem is there is an antidote for it, but that's not approved for humans either. So you can't give that to humans. But increasingly, we first saw it in Philadelphia and Baltimore and a couple other places. LA is now seeing a lot of it. We have it here in Burlington. And xylazine or tranq is, unfortunately, it causes these huge skin lesions that are really difficult to treat. We're seeing them. Like I said, my husband's a physician at University of Vermont. He's seeing them. And tranq and fentanyl mixed together are particularly icky. The other thing is we need to talk to kids about the fact that mixing anything, like if you're mixing Ambien and alcohol, that's a particularly deadly combination. So mixing things, really, really bad idea, but can also give kids an excuse for why they can't use. So for example, there's 2.5 pages in the addiction inoculation of excuses that teenagers told me about that they feel like they can use if they don't just feel comfortable saying no. We talk all the time about the fact that no is a complete sentence. But if they don't want to lose face or they don't want to feel stupid or whatever, they can use these excuses. And some of them are, I'm taking an antibiotic, I can't drink, or I am taking this other drug for my migraines and it doesn't mix well with this other thing. That's also a great excuse for why, for not to use.
A couple of reminders on the fentanyl front, one being that the harm reduction kits are unbelievable, critical, but they're not perfect. And they're not perfect because, of course, we all have heard many times, Dolly Clock has been on this podcast talking about it, that in order to adequately test a drug, you have to test the whole drug.
Yeah.
And, right. So it's complicated, but it's very important. And then the other side of that coin being that there are drugs that are lethal that don't have opiates in them.
Right.
And so there are lots and lots of stories about people who have overdosed and there is Narcan that is administered with this assumption that they're going to wake up and everything's going to be okay. And for kids to understand and for their caretakers to understand that there's so many different ways drugs work in the brain and you get into all of it in such an accessible way. The one thread I wanted to pull out from what you were saying.
Can I add something really quickly to that, which is, so because fentanyl and xylazine are being seen a lot together and Narcan does nothing for xylazine, but it does for fentanyl, you know, the powers that be, the best recommendations we have are if you think someone's on xylazine, give them the Narcan anyway, because they're likely to also be on an opioid at the same time.
I mean, it's like using an EpiPen. If you think someone's having an allergic reaction, use the EpiPen. Nothing bad will happen to them other than they'll feel like they're over-caffeinated. Okay, fine. You know, same with Narcan.
But you can give two. In fact, most harm reduction kits come with two doses of Narcan because it's not uncommon to have to give a second one. Although research just came out a couple days ago showing that repeated Narcan may not help. Like if so, anyway, mm-hmm. that if they don't wake up after the first one, that they may not wake up after this, they're less likely to wake up after the second, but give them the second dose. It's not going to hurt them.
Yeah, that's exactly yeah. right. The place I think I would love to land is just to pull one thread out. You were talking a lot about what different parents and caretakers can do and say, and then mm-hmm. you sort of threw in there a little bit of a huge piece of your expertise, which is school-based education. Right. And I just want to sort of land at making the plug for why parents should not outsource this education mm-hmm. to schools entirely, why getting comfortable with these uncomfortable conversations is critical. And maybe you can just talk a little bit about sort of the role of having these conversations at home in addition to having them at schools. Mm-hmm.
First, I'd love to say that schools can be allies. You cannot count on the school giving a thorough and effective, as I said, only 57% and only 10% of those 57%. And that's just high schools. That's where it's most likely to happen. But there are other allies that you can really look to that I want to make sure I give a plug to. And those are school counselors. Today, school counselors have master's degrees, school nurses, your primary care physician. Most primary care physicians for kids are at least aware that there are multiple screening questions that they can give to understand kids' risk factors. So one of them I talk about in the book, for example, is ESPERT, which is screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment. And that it's really important that your kid understands that you talk to your kid about the fact that the information that you give your doctor, you should be really honest with your doctor because your doctor's not trying to get you in trouble. Your doctor is trying to take good care of you and help you, you know, blah, blah, blah. So allies, super important, but we can't rely on that. So from my perspective, I'm just going to assume that no one's doing that. And on top of that, because my kids have a genetic predisposition for substance use disorder, it's particularly urgent because it is so much more likely that my kids are going to go down this path. So we're going to talk about a lot of things like the difference between what it feels like when you move from social use to problematic use, when you're looking forward to it a little too much, or you're realizing that your first thought is, oh, that was a stressful day, I need a drink, or when you've had two or three drinks and you realize that you don't know how to stop yourself, or you can't stop yourself from having the next one. Or, you know, there's all kinds of things we talk about that are little warning signs, lights that should go off. The problem is, even when someone knows all those warning signs, they can go off and go off, and you tend to like put little blinders on and not look that way. But those are all those puzzle pieces that I talked to you about. So as a parent, if my kid gets drunk at a party and they have track practice the next day, or they have to go to school the next day and they feel awful, you better believe I'm making that kid go to school, because that it has the potential to be a massive puzzle piece. So when I give my kid breaks because they're not feeling up to it, because I suspect they may have overindulged the night before, or even if they just didn't go to bed on time the night before, I want them to feel the natural consequences of that action so that they will make that connection in their brain and say, oh, I went to sleep too late, I felt crappy in the morning. So when there's potential for those lessons, do not intervene and do an end run around those lessons, because those lessons are not just important for, you know, their learning and adulting and making connections in their brain, but for the possibility that some of those puzzle pieces are going to fall into place.
Jess, we could talk to you forever and ever and ever, but I know our listeners have so much to unpack, and all of your work is so incredible. And we're also lucky to have it in the world and to get to hear from you. So thank you for joining us today and giving us a total geek out deep dive on all of the statistics and the science. We know our audience is going to love it.
Can I put in a pitch for... So that you could read the books, you could listen to the audiobook, as we talked about before, but also I make these daily videos that are up on Instagram and on TikTok. Well, here's the thing. So there are a lot of them now. So I had to put like an organized table of content somewhere. So if you go to jessicalahey.com, under videos, there's a menu item for the addiction inoculation, and there's a menu item for the gift of failure. And they're indexed there by subject, and all you have to do is click on those.
I'm not going to lie. I did it last night, and it was amazing. It was, and my husband and I watched, I don't know how many of your videos. They are short. They
90 are seconds.
So well done. They are so non-intimidating. For anyone who feels like you just have to toe into this, they are the perfect toe in.
Oh, I'm so glad. Well, and the thing is, you don't just need this information once. It's sort of like when I was picturing writing Gift of Failure or The Addiction Inoculation, there's a wonderful, wonderful book by Tina Payne Bryson called Bottom Line for Baby. She wanted to create a resource where you can go, you can see what the evidence is, you can see, yeah, there it is, and you can see what the bottom line is. And essentially, that's what I wanted, was something where you could go back and you could say, okay, well, I dealt with that a couple of years ago, but I think I need a refresher on that. So that's why those videos are indexed the way they are, because I need a refresher on that stuff.
Right.
It's, you know, it's complicated. The research is changing all the time, which is fascinating and fun. And that's the other thing I do videos on, is if a new study comes out, as one did last week, and I reported on the survey of why adolescents say they use drugs and alcohol, which was really interesting. That was in MMWR just 2 weeks ago.
We're going to link to your videos and also all the amazing resources that you talk about throughout the episode, of course, including your own books, which are incredible. And we love
I them. Don't care how people get this information. It's just too important not to at least know the basics.
Thank you, Jess. It was great to have
you.
You.
Thank you so, so much for having me.
We absolutely love hearing your feedback and getting all your questions. So anytime you want to be in touch, email us at thepubertypodcast@gmail.com. If you're looking for great puberty products like the Oom shorts or the Oom socks or the Oom bra, you get the theme there, go to myoomla.com. If you want more content, you love what we do on the Puberty Podcast, and you want to have us come speak or learn more about our book or subscribe to our amazing newsletter, The Awkward Roller Coaster, go to orderofmagnitude.co. Remember, it's .co because we don't have enough money to buy .com. Yet.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.